like I said, I think this church behaved well. The people in the church behaved well. There's not really much you can do. Although my organist was saying, well, he would crank the organ up to 11. as it goes.
And don't even look at it, but he would crank it.
Grace, and we can all sing Amazing Grace until they get tired and go away.
Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. We are recording this episode on Tuesday, January 20th, 2026. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of Holy Trinity Parish in Hillsdale, Michigan. Gentlemen, how are you today?
Excellent. Thank you.
Good, Nick. Thanks.
I wanted to bring up quickly just here at the beginning an email that we got to the mailbag last week about our alleged inability to let the Episcopal Church go. We did talk about the comments of the Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire, and somebody wrote in about how we're clearly just sort of letting our histories with the Episcopal Church cloud everything that we think and do. I'm probably exaggerating. I don't have the email in front of me, but what do you guys make of that criticism and suggestion that we move on?
Well, certainly one we've heard before. And, you know, the problem is that, I mean, the short answer to that is we talk about the Episcopal Church because in certain construals, we're watching the ACNA slowly become, or at least succumb to the same temptations the Episcopal Church did, which got it into the situation it is now. You know, the hand-wringing, the lack of decisiveness, the inability to reconcile theological controversies, as the Brits would say, you know, the emphasis on secondary matters and so on and so forth. And it's alarming. I mean, frankly, you know, I mean, people have sacrificed a lot and people have lost a lot. And that's not a reason necessarily to, I mean, that's not a point of valor or anything. It's just a fact. And, you know, many of those people have gone to glory. The ones that I think about when I consider not only staying in the ACNA, but also, as it were, fighting for it and her future. And, you know, as disappointing as some of the developments can and have been, I nevertheless think of them and say, you know, I've sacrificed relatively little compared to some of them and gave up certainly not a whole career in light of what some of them had done. And I'm, you know, feel obligated to at the very least stay and point out at whatever points needed to be made, at least just from my perspective, some of the same trajectories, some of the same compromises, and some of the same fault lines that we hopefully will avoid. But that's why I talk about the Episcopal Church. I could care less to a certain degree. I mean, the Episcopal Church in Hillsdale has like seven people in it or something. I mean, it's not an entity. It's got a nice building that we, you know, someday somebody will be able to turn into something, hopefully a church again. But in terms of practically speaking, I don't think about the Episcopal Church other than the similarities that are often we recognize having been there and don't want to repeat the mistakes of the past.
Yeah, I agree with all that. It's also, you know, it was a great liberating thing to be brought out of that place. So, I mean, it's kind of like asking.
Amen.
Asking Moses to stop talking about Egypt and the Red Sea. I mean, what do you know? We're going to keep talking about Egypt and the Red Sea because we don't want to, like you say, we don't ever want to go back there, but we also want to remember what God has done for us. And I don't have any personal bitterness toward the Episcopal Church at all. Even when it was going on, I was indignant about the heresy, but I wasn't personally hurt or feeling like I need some kind of personal revenge. And I still don't. We came out of the deal much better than we had with things, with a church building and a situation far better than we had when we were in the Episcopal Church. So there'd be no reason for me to feel bitterness. It's also like, it's just a classic picture of the death of a mainline church. And it's kind of a warning. The purpose of the Episcopal Church now is to stand as a warning for every other.
That's right.
Every other church,
like the heaps of stones in Joshua, so that everybody will remember.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right, Matt. I mean, I tell people all the time, like I was not only liberated, but my soul began to heal when I finally wasn't forced to obfuscate and qualify and hide, as it were, some true convictions about any number of things, at least in certain contexts. And so when people come to me now, even in, you know, current situation, and say, well, you know, this nuance, this, and maybe you should consider this, that, or the other, I say, listen, I did that for almost too long. And I just, you know, I may be wrong. And I certainly will go in open-handed and with what Peter says, gentleness and humility in terms of these discussions. But I'm certainly going to, you know, stand before the Lord with what I believe he's called us to teach, preach, and how to lead. And that was something that was being hamstrung at best, if hindered, if not worse, for 12 years of my ordained life. And I just have no interest in being back in that. And so some of the ways the conversations have developed and are being undertaken in the ACNA just have, well, to use the word, trigger me in terms of where we've been, you know, you know, we can only work with what we've been given and how we've gotten it. But that's the reason we talk about it. But it certainly isn't a sort of a longing for the flesh pots or looking back over my shoulder for Sodom. It's just a gratitude, a real deep gratitude for deliverance and the freedom that the ACNA does, to be fair, and by God's grace will continue to provide Orthodox, biblical, Anglican preachers, teachers, and congregants for generations to come.
It's worth saying that, if in case this listener is currently listening, that this advice to let the Episcopal Church go was given in the context of a general thank you for our work and a general enjoyment of the show. So it was definitely a friendly email.
Amendment. That's right. That's right. Effusive, even in.
Well, you guys, more crazy news out of Minnesota this week. A crowd of protesters interrupted a service at City's Church in St. Paul because one of the pastors there also holds a job with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. He's the acting director of the local field office. And we'll talk about that quote-unquote protest in a second, but there's a bit of ACNA news we wanted to get to first. So in the press release following the College of Bishops meeting in Florida last week, the bishops called for a provincial assembly to fast-track ratification of the Title IV revision, the update to our safeguarding and disciplinary canons that everyone seems to agree is sorely needed. In the midst of that announcement, though, the bishops announced that, quote, the Governance Task Force, GTF, has had an initial consultation with Rachel Denhollander, an attorney and leading expert in helping religious institutions properly respond to and prevent abuse. As part of the final public review cycle, that's of Title IV, the provincial office and the Anglican Diocese of the Carolinas have agreed to retain Ms. Denhollander to consult and provide additional feedback to the GTF about trauma-informed best practices. So there's some controversial stuff there, everything from the term trauma-informed to the fact of Denhollander's participation fresh off her involvement with the Southern Baptist Convention. So guys, before we get to Minnesota, what do you make of the bishop's announcement?
Aside from that part, there's some good stuff in there. You know, I was glad that they affirmed Bishop Dobbs's role as the interim person acting he's not the archbishop, but acting in the role of leading the province at this point. So that was good. They affirmed that despite what was posted in the Washington Post about him. So that was good. But yeah, Rachel Denhollander is a real problem if we're going to be using her as a consultant for anything related to abuse cases or clergy discipline. Her role in the Southern Baptist Convention and the mess that emerged from various accusations of sexual assault or sexual abuse, her role was one in which her ethics have been really seriously questioned. I mean, she was playing a dual role as both an advocate for victims and a lawyer for one of the people who were allegedly a victim, and at the same time consulting as a consultant for the denomination about how to change their policy. So that's a conflict of interest, a pretty serious conflict of interest that she was involved in. That was reported in the Baptist News, which is not a conservative Baptist News Global. It's not a conservative site. Her ethical boundary crossing is on one level is very concerning. The other level, of course, is her advocacy for trauma-informed, you mentioned this, trauma-informed care, which does seem to short-circuit things like due process in favor of not allowing words to be spoken or things to be said or investigations to be done in a way that might, in her view and other people who are trauma-informed view, cause quote-unquote further harm to the alleged victim. But while no one wants to cause any harm to anybody, that's a great thing. But the investigations need to be done in a way that upholds our basic standards of justice, and so that means that there has to be a defense of the person who's accused. You can't just assume the guilt of the person who's accused and go on with that assumption. There's got to be due process. So a lot of other problems with the trauma-informed program. There's no sense in which sin can be spoken of on the part of.
There's any agency, you know. It infantilizes the quote unquote victim. I mean, I'm only saying quote unquote because many of these are in the process of being adjudicated, and you know, and then removes agency entirely from, in the construals it often is presented, you know, the person with less power in some capacity over against the quote unquote powerful. And that's already been defined from the outset. And so there's no even discussion really about what constitutes even that dynamic. And, you know, we've talked about this before, I think way back when the Me Too was sort of at its height, that, you know, of course there are clear and obvious sins that are then also in many cases criminal actions that we hope are exposed and judged rightly, and the victims are at least there's justice brought to the victims at the very least in the punishment of the perpetrator. But you know, many of these discussions, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head about Megan Basham's been going on and on about the, I forget the names, but there was one high profile case where it was like a 12-year relationship with you know an older man and a younger woman who was still in her late to mid 20s or mid to late 20s at the time. And it's just, it sort of stretches the any classic understanding of a perpetrator and victimhood when you have a 12-year consensual adult sinful relationship that somehow can then be turned into something more than what it is. And what it is, to be quite, you know, frank and obvious, is sinful disqualification from ministry at the very least, if not, you know, civil suits and all the things that come with that. But to add this layer of relatively modern understanding of, quote, trauma as this undefined blunt force instrument that can be utilized to further aggravate a sad situation has proven to be, well, complicated would be a polite way to put it, you know, fraught would be another. And, you know, I think rightly, at least the Southern Baptists are very suspicious of her involvement in their situation. And I don't see any wisdom at all in further complicating our lives with, as you pointed out, Matt, someone that has this track record that she's had, this well documented. Is there no other person in the world? Is there no other group, you know, even if you thought that was a good idea to involve yourself in our church affairs? But, you know, they didn't ask me, so...
I mean, in one sense, I'm for like all eyes on the Title IV revisions. Like, that's fine. We can have anybody look at them. But yeah, I happen to know that there are lawyers who know, for instance, how Anglican churches work and how Anglican churches are organized.
She is an evidence of what JD was saying about trauma-informed and victim advocacy in the Me Too type context. The case you're talking about was between a professor, there was an affair between a professor named Sills, his last name, and Leah.
That's right.
And yeah, you're right. It was going on for 12 years. And in the context of this kind of thought, if there's a power differential, the professor and say this, and I think she was a student when the affair began, then what that does is it removes any kind of responsibility.
That's right.
For a person with a less power in the situation. So it doesn't matter what she does. It's the weight of this, of the affair, the weight of the adultery was all on him. And it wasn't just adultery, it was abuse.
Well, he's lucky that that stopped short of the Bathsheba was raped argument. That's the same argument.
That's what I was going to bring that up, because Rachel Denhollander did enter the ranks of that. That debate on Twitter back when it was still called Twitter. And she said, if you don't think that Bathsheba was raped, you have no business. I think she said, I'm not quoting here because I can't remember that far back, but something like, you have no business being a clergyman if you don't think that Bathsheba was actually raped. I don't think that she was making an argument from the text based on the script, the words in the text. I think she was talking about the power differential. Regardless of how it went down, even if Bathsheba was totally willing partner, the power differential there was such that that she was necessarily raped. And you know, biblically speaking, we don't cart in ideologies and theories and psychological ideals to use to interpret the scriptures. We let the scriptures interpret our ideals and our theologies, our ideologies. And so, when we have, say, a case like Potiphar's wife, who had greater power than Joseph, making the moves on Joseph and Joseph resisting, according to this mindset, if Joseph hadn't resisted, if he just would have given right in and begun this affair with Potiphar's wife and just had let her have his way with her way with him, then it wouldn't have been sin at all. It would have been fine. But Joseph, the words from Joseph's mouth tell us that the scriptures teach otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, this is we've talked about this before, but you know, it's coming up again that you know, the entire, as you said, Matt, the whole sort of power differential is always, at least in many of these cases. Well, I don't know of any exception, positing that the woman in the relationship is somehow, you know, there's a power imbalance towards the man, and that sort of relativizes original sin and doesn't do. You know, ironically, it sort of infantilizes and, as I said before, takes agency away from women. You know, presenting them as always the helpless, powerless party. And it's just, you know, there's a sort of a catch 22 in the entire argument, because simultaneously there's this push towards equality and sort of equal standing in every situation, and yet, in this particular type instance, it's an immediate assumption of guilt. And, you know, you just, again, the biblical examples you brought up, Matt, speak to it, but also just straight up human experience shows that there are, you know, the complex web of male-female relations is much more complicated and multifaceted than just, you know, men bad, women good, you know, sugar and spice and everything nice, and that's what little girls are made of, sort of thing. And yet, that is the underlying sort of assumption. And it's just sad to see, you know, it's hard not to see this also as kind of the fruit of the I forget who said it, but, you know, in the Ruck trial, you know, there were people basically like, we're going to take a break for Christmas and then we're going to come back and revisit all these things, you know, because the verdict wasn't what some people wanted or expected. And it's hard not to think that this was at least being considered, if not planned, in light of that, you know, that exoneration of him. You know, when I read it, I immediately said, oh, well, you know, despite the fact that we had a process that took 6 years and reached a verdict that some people are upset with, it will never suffice. Until I'm not sure what happens, but this seems to be just a further continuance of that unpleasant reality that we had thought had been run its course, and yet we're going to jump all right back into it, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the greatest, most damaging thing that the LGBTQ movement does is it cuts off the avenue of repentance. I mean, it helps people caught up in sin to justify themselves and they're not going to repent. That's the same thing. If you're a woman who has engaged in an adulterous affair with a man, maybe your boss or your teacher, this kind of ideology teaches you don't have to repent, and that's deadly. It's spiritually deadly. So because you can't, if there's no repentance, there's no confession of sin, then you can't have the gospel. So it cuts people off from salvation, I think. All right, we should probably change subject, though, because we have another thing to talk about.
Yeah, well, why don't you guys give us your reaction? Obviously, you would be anti the ability of angry mobs to shut down Sunday worship services and churches. What do you make of this whole thing?
Well, I think it was a big mistake on the part of those who did it. I mean, they didn't, you would think usually these people have like some legal consultant or someone who knows the law well enough, but you can't just go barging into a church and interrupt the services. That's illegal. And if you've watched any of the news coverage, you know, it's the FACE Act. And I think they're going to go after Don Lemon with the Klan Act, which is an act from 1870 something, I think, which was designed to protect freed slaves and their voting rights. But anytime you interfere with someone engaging in a right guaranteed by the Constitution, you try to interrupt that or interfere with that, then you have committed a federal crime. And that's what's happened. And they took their cameras in there and they videoed themselves. So that it was a bad mistake on their part. I can see why they did it. I mean, I think so, like you said earlier at the beginning, that this one of the pastors was a high monkey monk in the ICE in the region, and so they thought, well, we'll go and interrupt their service and disrupt their time together, just like these ICE people are disrupting the families and people who are here from other countries. So, but on the legal standpoint, they're in trouble, I think. But also, I mean, this is a Church of the Living God. These people were engaging in not just a right under the Constitution, but they were engaging in the worship of the Living God. So the violation goes far deeper than just a constitutional one. It's an offense against God. It's a sign or a kind of an icon of the hostility that the world bears toward Christ and his people. So it's in some ways the way the church reacted was perfectly. They didn't fight. They didn't scream. No one threw any punches. They just were calm. Those who did speak tried to talk about Jesus, which is great. And then they got the people, the mothers and fathers, took their children away as they could and comforted them. The whole thing optically, so from a legal standpoint, from a theological standpoint, terrible, terrible, terrible error of judgment and sin. And then also optically, I mean, the politically speaking, the ICE arrests had been growing in unpopularity over the week before because of the death of the shooting of Ms. Good. I think the church invasion just stopped all that momentum and maybe even pushed it in the other direction. So it was a political mistake too, I think.
What do you make of the argument that a pastor in the Church of Jesus Christ can't be? Because what I've been seeing online is that you can't, you know, serve Christ and fascism, which is sort of like I've seen people trying to single out ICE as an organization as though it's not part of the federal government. Like, is the argument that you can't be a pastor and a mail carrier? Is the argument that you can't work for like the Energy Commission? Or is it somehow that because of what ICE is doing is somehow uniquely evil, you would need to step down from that role? How do you think that people are thinking about that sort of like conjunction between working for the church and working for the government?
I think the way the argument goes is if you decide that anybody here who is an immigrant necessarily gets all of the blessings of the Levitical law because they're immigrants, sojourners, then a pastor working for an organization that's arresting people who are here and sending them away out of the country, if you already have that presupposition, well, then that's a contradiction. Those two things can't go together. Of course, the flaw is that the immigrants that are being arrested and deported are necessarily like those immigrants or by like those sojourners in under Levitical law. Every nation that is called itself a nation has to have some kind of border control. some right to decide who comes in and who doesn't come in our country. And Israel did too. That's the irony, is that the Levitical laws were very clear about what sojourners were allowed to do and not allowed to do in Israel, and how you became classified as a sojourner. But if you come into, generally speaking, this is not just America, but if you enter into a nation illegally, that nation has the right to send you away. And there's nothing biblically that would prevent a pastor from serving in the organization that does that work.
One would assume that a pastor working in such a job would advocate for his agents to do their job properly and to seek right. to follow the law. And if somebody was overzealous or doing something illegal or operating in a way that was inappropriate, that you would want a Christian, perhaps even a pastor, to be there to say, this is wrong, and we need to fix this. We need to adjudicate this. We need to get you out of this role. You're clearly not doing a good job. We want people who will do a good job in those roles. I mean, ICE is not a creature of Donald Trump. And there's been some sort of immigration and naturalization service for decades. And ICE as itself has existed since 2002.
Well, I mean, it goes back to, I mean, Christian history is full of this debate. You know, usually is it concerned soldiers? You know, that was one of the earliest considerations for the early Christian church. You know, how can you prosecute a war, you know, as a Christian? Or, you know, and of course it has questions of pacifism and anti-violence and all the things. And, you know, to say that it's been an easy reconciled sort of question is the same sort of naivete that we were talking about before, where there's complexities to it. There is thoughtfulness that has to be brought, wisdom that has to be brought to bear. And, you know, with about all the things that we've been speaking, this particular issue, you know, it's not, like we talked about a couple weeks ago, as clear as, you know, ICE is fascist and evil and authoritarian, and all of the every single person that they're rounding up and sending home is a victim. I know, you know, at least if the news is correct, there have been some overreach and there have been some mistakes made. And, you know, in our increasingly transparent system, not totally transparent, but at the very least, every other thing being videoed, I'm grateful that those cases, at least, I mean, you hear the people's names or the specific instances, and, you know, I'm grateful that errors can and have been corrected, and we'll probably hear more of those. But you're right, Matt, in general, the fundamental assumption, like we've talked about, is one that you either, the premise is something you either affirm or deny. And it's hard to justify from a Christian perspective, with Romans 13 even hanging in the background and our American system of government, that you have the obligation as a pastor to thwart the legal exercise of a federal officer doing just about anything. I mean, you know, you can be really upset about it. We can vote different people in. We can talk about it. We could, you know, stand up in civil disobedience and write letters from prison, you know, as has been done, and to great effect. But the argument that somehow there's a moral legitimacy and imperative for Christians to somehow stand up against this agency at this moment for these reasons seems indefensible, unless, as you said, Matt, there's some prior assumptions that are not biblical and certainly not legal. And, you know, that's the situation we find ourselves in, is that there are people who fundamentally seem to have a problem with the entire system of government, established law and authority, Western civilization, even. I mean, I was listening to a podcast with John Stone Street and Elisa Childers the other day, John Stone Street of the Colson Center. And it was, you know, about the war on Western civilization, you know, using the Truth Rising documentary. If you haven't seen that, it's remarkable. And, you know, getting us to a point where the question really is going to be asked about these assumptions is like, do you actually think that this way of government that we have inherited, that the checks and balances, the division of power, the, you know, representative democracy, you know, all of the various components that we have been bequeathed, is that something that we should continue to
work within and, you know, change when necessary, and watch it develop and hopefully be, you know, corrected over time to the extent that we find flaws, or does it need to be replaced entirely? And I think that's actually the foundation of what a lot of these conversations are. Now, to be sure, the people involved in it may not be able to articulate it that clearly, but, you know, when you have people justly defending the taunting and even trying to impede the lawful exercise of federal agency just because they disagree with the premise, you're close to anarchy. I mean, you're close to lawlessness, and that's a frightening thing to consider. And it seems like, again, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I know some that's the intent behind all of these various aggressions, or the aggrieved nature of all of these complaints, is fundamentally that the system, the country, the sort of Western way of jurisprudence and legal foundations and the rule of law and all of it in whole needs to be torn down and rebuilt. And of course, people have said that much explicitly. It's just never in America, or at least not, you know, not as full-throatedly as they have. But there is precedent for that sentiment. And unfortunately, it seems to have hit our shores, you know, about 100, 150 years later than others. And I simply pray that those voices lose, that they're, you know, not removed, but that they're exposed. And then the genuine gratitude for the system, however imperfect it is, that we have inherited, will be reestablished, and something of a grateful or gratitude and a hopefulness will be reinstilled in sort of the American populace. But right now it's certainly a mess.
Let me push back just for a second with something that I've also seen online. I think from people on the left who are seemingly incorporating into their argument a willingness for deportation in general. Like, you'll see somebody talk about how many people were deported under Obama. So they're trying to compare a sort of less violent, less of a struggle program of deportations as compared to what's happening now with ICE under Trump, and saying they were deporting people peacefully. Now we've got all this violence and trauma. What's the difference?
From my understanding, the difference is in the way the state's cooperating with the authorities. So Minneapolis is a city run, the mayor of the city has made it clear he does not want his police officers are not cooperating with ICE. And the same thing is true on statewide with Governor Walz. So that makes it a lot more difficult for ICE to do its job. And it has to, it's not a police force. It is an enforcement force. Finding illegal aliens and getting them out of the country, but it's having to do like jobs. It's not task. It's not really designed for. Go to other places, go to the states like Florida, Texas, other places where the governor and mayors are cooperating with ICE. And you don't see this because there's no recourse to the kind of obstacle. There's no the obstacles in their way are not there. I mean, put on top of having to go and find the people who are here illegally, you've got mass protests, people obstructing your job, obstructing your mission, protesters, police not doing anything about it. So you've got three things in play, or two things here in play that are not in other states. The protesters trying to stop you every move you make, and the police who are not helping you by controlling the protesters or acting in ways to help you do your investigation.
That's right. And the local officials instigating and raising the rhetoric themselves against the very government that they have been, you know, sworn at the very least to execute and to oversee. And you have people like Tim Walz, you know, essentially vindicating any sort of, you know, up to violent action against these federal agents. You know, you add that into the mix too. And then, of course, like last week, you throw a bishop or two in there who thinks that this is the defining moment of civil disobedience and possible martyrdom of our time. And you've got an incredibly toxic cocktail, as they say. And I'm not surprised that people who are already
you know, for whatever reason, prone to, you know, despondency, despair, and anger towards any number of things. But, you know, Trump doesn't help or hasn't helped people's sort of rational capacity to reason. You know, that's what we're watching. And so I think you're exactly right, Matt, is that the leaders that have been called to, you know, shepherd their people and to, at the very least, even in disagreement, not help instigate violence are also culpable in this mess that we're watching roll out in real time.
Would you guys continue the worship service if a group of protesters came into your church?
Well, it has provoked a lot of conversation. On our vestry, you know, threads, we're talking about what we would do. We already have, it's really important, I think, for churches to have security team nowadays, especially because you don't know what people will do. You don't want the people in your church to be harmed by violence or by this sort of thing. So if you have a security team well trained and prepared for these sorts of things, they won't even get through the door. I don't think this group would have gotten through our doors.
No,
because we've cordoned off everything. We only have one entryway, one exit. It's guarded at all times during the service. Someone comes in, a group of people come in like that, they wouldn't get far. I hope everyone who has been paying attention to the news, every Christian, every pastor, this is a good time to have conversations with your board, with your vestry, with whatever it is, your leaders, and put together some kind of security plan. I don't know what would you do in this situation if a group like that did manage to get in and was just making all kinds of noise. Like I said, I think this church behaved well. The people in the church behaved well. There's not really much you can do. Although my organist was saying, well, he would crank the organ up to 11.
As it goes. And don't even look at it, but he would crank it.
Grace, right. And we can all sing Amazing Grace until they get tired and go away.
Yeah, we talked with we had a vestry meeting last night, and, you know, I was just saying, I wonder what would happen. And, you know, the more difficult position would be if one or two people just kind of came in and then had plans to, you know, stand up in the middle and disrupt. We wouldn't really know how to, you know, we welcome people that we don't know every Sunday by God's grace. But yeah, if there was like a concerted mob with a CNN camera crew and Don Lemon, you know, right there at the door, I mean, at the very least there would have been a confrontation well before I think I would have been aware of it. Although now that I'm east facing, I just tell the guys, well, they get one shot off. I may not see it coming and see in glory, but that'll be it. So there we have it. That's about it, huh?
How do we end a conversation like this?
You know, we're praying for the provincial council, and, you know, I mean, there is, despite all of the concern, you know, I'm still glad for the ACNA and pray for the leadership, and grateful for the bishops who have shown such humility and long suffering and introspection, and am grateful for you know, their leadership and their witness and their and pray and in fact trust and hope, or hope and trust, that this, we will look back on this as a season of difficulty in the life of the ACNA, but not unlike, you know, if you look at the lifespan of a human, you know, adolescent troubles can sometimes lay the foundation for stronger and more secure adulthood. And I think that's what we're walking through. And I just pray
speaking
that the wisdom
as the
that,
parent of adolescence, from your lips to God's ears, please.
Well, speaking as a former adolescent with future adolescents, I can just say that with all fear and trembling myself. So
amen.
We have it.
Well, I guess that's going to be all the time that we have today. Thanks, as always, for listening to Stand Firm this week. If you want to keep the conversation going, please be in touch with us. Rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com or join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks, as always, to J.D. Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Landon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.